Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Please take care of yourself.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 226. Buiti binafi and bienvenidos bitches. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.
Now, Fruit Loops is a podcast. That's right. You're listening in your ears about true crimes committed by people of color and those who are othered and the victims. Because contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender, able-bodied white dudes. That's
what?
Right. Now, you're not going to believe this, but these crimes, they exist. There's many of them, but they rarely get any public attention because the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman, and I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
That's right. You know what? It's just a part of who we are, one part that informs our perspectives.
Yeah.
And that's why we bring it up.
Yes. And we are not journalists, investigators, or psychologists.
No.
Just a couple of gals interested in true crime.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinion. So take that as you will.
If they're like buttholes, everyone
has one. Everyone's got one.
So who are we talking about today, friend?
Well, today we're talking about Walter E. Ellis, a.k.a. the Milwaukee North Side Strangler, or just the North Side Strangler, a Black man and serial killer responsible for the deaths of at least seven women, most likely more, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And this story was suggested to us by our fruity Pamela.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you, Pamela.
Before we get into it, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm a little exhausted because I was on vacation with my daughter and my grandson.
Yeah.
And my grandson is just a ball of energy. He just goes all day long from the time we get up till we go to sleep. So, now I need a vacation from my vacation.
He really, really doesn't get tired or think
No.
That is incredible.
And
that
he's been like that since he was like, I don't know, three? Like he stopped taking naps. And he's exhausting.
You know, I want whatever he has because I've been fighting off yawns.
Yeah.
As long as we've been on this line right now.
And can we get a little bit of that and
you
can have some chill?
Yeah, share it. Share it with the rest of us.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Well, great now. We had a pipe bust in my house. And I'm not going to name names, but it was definitely old Whitey's fault. And he caused a mini flood inside our house.
Like
inches of water. We caught it fast.
That's good.
And, this is a weird Wendy fact. I've flooded my parents' home like more than once.
Like so at the toilet or something?
No, like, I don't know if I should go. Like one time I was supposed to fill up the dog's water using the hose, but it was wintertime, kinda, and the hose was frozen. So I left the hose in the basement, like embankment window.
To thaw out or something?
No, I just left it there because I had to go to school. Oh. Water wasn't coming out. And I was like, fuck this shit. I didn't even bother turning it off.
Oh, my God.
When I got home, boy, oh, boy, were my parents mad.
I bet.
So anyway, I knew what to do when you have a flood in the home because I'd experienced it before. And so, you know, we got the water out, used a broom to like push it out real fast.
Right.
Got heaters and fans, everything dried up. But we couldn't get a plumber out right away. And so we had to like poop in buckets for a day and go to the gym up the street to, you know, use the facilities and stuff like that. So it was extremely inconvenient.
Yeah.
I would say an inconvenient adventure. But I obviously know that we're very lucky and blessed. You know, this was nothing compared to the struggles of other people, but it was extremely
inconvenient.
Yeah.
Not fun. Not fun.
Yeah. Thanks, friend, for understanding. So now let's get into some listener letters.
Great. Well, thank you, angels.
All right. What's in that bag, Beth?
Well, there's nothing in this bag.
Oh, sad face. Sad face alert. Aww.
But if you have any questions or comments, please send them to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at
602-935-6294.
And we may feature it on a future episode. But if you don't want us to, just let us know and we won't do it.
Oh, yeah. We're not out here to
cause
anybody stress, strife, or none of that stuff.
Nope.
But I will also say, just to remind the listeners that this month we're skipping our meetup because it's somebody's birthday.
No. It's Easter.
Okay,
Easter.
Whatever. Whatever. There's a lot going on.
We usually do it on the last Sunday of the month, and this last Sunday of the month is Easter, so we're gonna skip it. We would have done it sooner, but we just have too much
going
on.
Yeah, but stay tuned for April.
Yeah,
for the end of the month, and if you want to join us for just kind of like a happy hour where we just talk about true crime, and
hang out,
what's going on, all the things. Then we would love to have you. We had so much fun on this last one. We're kind of switching up the format.
A number of people who joined us, and it was really fun.
It was amazing. I cannot say this enough. You guys who listen to the show, tell your friends about it. Support us on Patreon. Buy the merch. Go to CrimeCon to say hi and things like that. Like, we just appreciate it so much. We love you.
Yeah. We have the best listeners. We really do.
Fight me. Yes, we do. I will square up. So I'm going to square up with somebody because, yes, the Fruities are the best, period.
Yeah.
So let's take a quick break, and then we're going to get into the story when we come back.
Okay. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering?
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's betterhelp.com/fruit.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
We're back! Remind us, Beth, who are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about Walter E. Ellis, a Black man and serial killer responsible for the deaths of at least 7 women over a period of over 2 decades.
Whoa.
His victims were mostly Black women and girls who ranged in age from 16 to 41. And this case resulted in the false convictions of not one, but 2 different men. And also a third man had to go to trial.
Yeah.
But he was acquitted, mm-hmm. but still.
Yeah, yeah. Still. There's a lot of people left in the wake of this
yes.
case. And so that brings us to our Love and Light segment, where we just say rest in power to the victims, but also love and light and healing energy to the people left behind, the survivors of the victims. And when I say victims, also the murder victims and the people who were wrongfully convicted, and the community, as yeah. I understand it, was also quite shaken about all of this throughout the saga. And so just love and light to all of them. And so now we're going to read the names of the victims. Again, rest in power to these queens. Deborah Harris, 31. Tanya Miller, 19. Irene Smith was 25. Karen Kilpatrick was 32. Jessica Payne was 16. Florence McCormick, 28. Sheila Farrior, 37. Joyce Mims, 41. Quithrion Stokes, 28. Mariette Griffin was 39 years old. And while we could not find much information about the victims, it is important to say they were all human beings who deserved, loved, and did not deserve to have their lives taken
yeah.
by this individual.
Yep.
So with that, let's move on to the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, the setting is Milwaukee, Wisconsin's largest city, which is located on Lake Michigan, where the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick rivers come together.
Mm-hmm.
People had lived there for more than 13,000 years prior to European invasion.
Yeah, just going to say, the history of indigenous people, I have noticed, it's almost like it's a blip. And then Europeans yeah. came, but they had advanced societies.
Thousands of years, yeah.
Yes, I mean, they were doing the things and
yeah.
Doing it well and fine, minding their business. But
yeah,
just wanted to mention that. But known as the gathering place by the waters, the good earth or good land, or simply the gathering place, Milwaukee, as they say in Wayne's World, was neutral ground shared by several native tribes, such as the Potawatomi, Ojibwe, Ottawa, Fox, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Sauk, and Oneida.
The earliest mention of Europeans in the area is a reference to an unnamed fur trader at Milwaukee in 1762. But it was in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War that Europeans first erected permanent settlements.
In 1785, French trader Alexis Laframboise erected a trading post in Milwaukee. And this was followed by a second store established by Jacques Viau in 1795 on behalf of the Northwest Fur Company.
Between 1835 and 1850, Milwaukee's population grew from a handful of fur traders to more than 20,000 settlers. And by 1846, When Milwaukee was incorporated, it rivaled Chicago in size and wealth.
Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy.
In 1910, there were less than 3,000 Black people settled in Wisconsin. By 1930, the Black population had increased to 7,000. But opportunities for Black folks were limited until World War II. At that time, due to a huge demand for factory goods, Black people were allowed to work in Milwaukee factories.
During the war, many Black people from Mississippi, Arkansas, Tennessee, and elsewhere in the South came to work in Milwaukee's factories, and most stayed to raise their families afterwards.
I think I was telling you the other day, like, I met a Black person who was born and raised in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
And
right.
I was like, what? This was years ago. But yeah, I was baffled. I really didn't know that there were Black people in Milwaukee like
the
that.
The Midwest.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I know Chicago has a lot of Black. Like, that's an obvious one. But right. Wisconsin? Wisconsin? The Wisconsin Black population increased almost 600%.
Wow.
From 12,000 in 1940 to 75,000 in 1960. But they remained concentrated in a few urban areas due to, you're not going to believe this, racist housing covenants and redlining, which we've talked about before, is the process of defining red zones on a map. And this was actually by realtors right. and banks decided these are poor places to sell homes because Black people live there. And by the way, 90% of Black people lived in Milwaukee, Beloit, Madison, Racine, and Kenosha.
By the 1960s, Milwaukee was 15% Black, but most Black residents were clustered in a northern neighborhood, or the North Side, that suffered from unemployment, poverty, and segregation. Mm. Local statutes, real estate agents, and lending institutions conspired to keep Black citizens confined to the inner city, and segregated neighborhoods produced segregated schools.
Yeah, and these segregated neighborhoods, it's not just the separation. It's everything that comes with it. Lower life expectancies in these neighborhoods compared to the adjacent wider ones next to them. And due to the struggle, poverty, essentially, crime it becomes a problem because people don't have what they need.
Yeah.
So when local codes and practices began to change in 1968, Milwaukee experienced white flight. Leaving the city. No, we got to get out of here. I would just love to talk to somebody who had it in there. Like, I know your parents weren't like this, but I am curious about why people, like, why did you flee?
What were they scared of?
What were you so scared of? But anyway, white flight, leaving the city as one of the most segregated in America to this day, despite all of the legislation and progress. Things are worse. So let's get into the early life of Walter E. Ellis. Hit it, Beth.
Walter E. Ellis was born on June 24th, 1960 in Holmes County, Mississippi, as one of six children to Leroy and Maddie Ellis. His nickname as a child was Waddell. And I think that was like a contraction of Walter and Ellis
Something like that. Makes sense. Yeah. It totally makes sense. Yeah.
It's kind of cute.
I knew a Waddell. Once.
Oh, and, did you?
But I never like inquired because it's a name I'd never heard before. Yeah.
Until Right.
Yeah. Now this is the second time.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
In the mid-1960s, the family left Mississippi and resettled in the north side of Milwaukee. They joined millions of Black Americans who left the South for economic opportunity and safety in places like Milwaukee and Chicago.
Beginning in early childhood, Walter showed signs of antisocial behavior, acting impulsively and aggressively towards his peers, frequently assaulting classmates and neighboring children. And he had a reputation as a bully and was frequently disciplined. And I just have a teeny tiny culture corner with Wendy and Beth. Now, while we don't know very much about Walter's childhood, given the time frame of his early years and considering, you know, America at the time, one can imagine that life for his parents was not easy, given segregation, racial violence, and the struggle to survive in Jim Crow America.
Right.
And Black men Walter's dad's age would leave their homes and go to work. And out in the world, they were bullied and bruised, sometimes physically and often emotionally, by the conditions of the Jim Crow era. And they had nowhere to place that energy and negativity until they returned home. And their families could sometimes be the victims of this maybe misplaced retaliation.
Take it out on their families.
And this is pure speculation, but it does appear reasonable to me to consider that there could have been some tension, bullying, and or abuse at his home.
Yeah.
Of course, not all those who are bullied become bullies themselves, and certainly not all bullies become serial killers. So there's that.
Yeah. In 1974, after finishing the eighth grade, Walter dropped out of school due to poor academic performance and chronic absenteeism. At 14, Walter was charged with attempted murder and attempted robbery, but he faced no time since he was a minor.
Mm. Those are heavy charges, though, for somebody so young.
14 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was charged two more times before he was 18 for robbery and theft. Ellis was arrested 12 more times between 1981 and 1998 and was in and out of prison during that time.
But neighbors who knew Ellis when he was an angry kid agree that he grew gentler as he grew older. But it was probably just a facade because little did they know that he was actually an abusive boyfriend and a serial killer.
Right. Yeah. He grew gentler and grew older, but really he just grew better at hiding it.
His anger. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now let's get into the timeline. Here we go. Deborah Harris was 31 years old and was Ellis's first known victim. She was described as generous, a loving person who had moved to Milwaukee for a better life. And Deborah was murdered on October 10th, 1986. Her body was found in a local river.
19-year-old Tanya Miller was found dead the following day. So one right after the other.
Yeah, that's no time at all.
No. She had been strangled to death and her body was found between a house and a garage.
It kind of makes you wonder, because some of these do happen in rapid succession.
Why
there wasn't. I'll get into this in my takes. Yeah. There's so much opportunity for this to have been stopped, the saga. But in January of 1990, Ellis joined a drug dealing gang known as the Brothers of the Struggle, which sounds like a good thing. But it is not.
Brothers struggling together.
Exactly.
But no,
yeah.
It's
let's
not,
lift
not
our, uplift our community, guys. Ready? Brothers of the Struggle on three. One, two, three. Brothers of the Struggle.
Break.
Yeah. But it wasn't that at all. So in June of that year, 1990, he was arrested for distributing drugs and convicted in November 1990 of the charge. Sentenced to 30 months, not very much time, Ellis served his time in a Minnesota prison and was released early in May 1992 for good behavior.
He returned to Milwaukee and tested positive for cocaine three times
before
his probation officer actually ordered him back to prison.
So my goodness.
Yeah, they're a little lax on that.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But the parole system. Now, it's much different than it was back then, but it's really easy to get sent back to prison for simple violations, drinking alcohol, being around somebody who's drinking alcohol, smoking weed, being in contact with other convicted felons, which, if you know anything about the prison industrial complex, is almost impossible to not do if you are already in the system, right? So,
There you go. All right. Then in November of 1992, Ellis was sent to a Salvation Army halfway house, which was used for federal prisoners. Inmates were allowed to leave the facility with permission for work, school, and church, but they needed a pass.
Of course.
Yeah.
So Ellis recognized one of the workers at the halfway house, a man named Carl Porter. They had served time together in prison in Green Bay. Ellis learned that prisoners would bribe Porter and others for passes. Their names were never put down on the pass list, and it would look on the record as if they had never left the halfway house. Not good.
No, not good at all. On November 27th, 1992, Ellis's pass records showed that he left the halfway house at 9 a.m. to look for work. And then he was back at 3 p.m. that afternoon.
Hmm.
But actually, he left later on that day. And under the bribe system, the log did not show it.
So this system is quite flawed.
Yes.
As are many systems, including the policing system. The prison system, all those things, the criminal justice system. But this is maddening.
Yeah.
Anyway, so early the next morning, the body of Irene Smith, 25 years old, was found in a trash bin in an alley off of North 7th Street. the same alley that ran behind the house where Ellis's mother lived, just a few blocks away. Irene had been stabbed in the neck and strangled. Detectives found DNA on her body that was later, much later, linked to Ellis.
On December 13th, 1992, Ellis left the halfway house and never came back. He was later arrested and faced a new charge for the escape and a return to prison to do more time. So Ellis then offered to make a deal with the federal investigators.
I wonder if this was his plan the whole time. You know,
probably not
to get leverage. Just always looking for leverage. No.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he probably
it was a spur of the moment. Oh, yeah, I could do this.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So he told authorities about the bribery system at the halfway house and offered to help get the corrupt halfway house workers who were selling prisoners passes for cash. Oh, my God. I'm Ellis. Officer, I'm here to help. My name is Walter Ellis. Arrest them.
These people are doing something very, very bad.
Oh, you're not going to believe this. Oh, my gosh. It's so terrible. I'm ashamed to even say. But I'll tell you all of it, he said, if they would give him his freedom.
He was interviewed by a U.S. Department of Justice special agent in January of 1993, after which time they set up surveillance on the halfway house and soon had the proof to back up Ellis's allegations. Federal authorities signed Ellis up as an informant, and he walked out of jail 3 weeks after he was arrested. He was off probation a few months later. So that was a good deal for him.
It was a good deal for him. I just, not a good deal for the community.
For everybody else.
Yeah. So Ellis was a key piece of the government's bribery case against Porter and another worker, Marlon Horde. Ellis was the first witness called in the trial. Porter pleaded guilty and received 14 months in prison, while Horde was acquitted. By the way, I just was thinking about his experience in the courtroom. Like, he's probably been in front of a judge numerous times.
Oh, yeah, multiple times.
Knows exactly what to say, how to finesse this and that to essentially get the best outcome for himself.
Yeah.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
That was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderick.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
So, freed by federal authorities, Ellis entered what state prosecutors later called his most violent years. On October 13, 1994, Karen Kilpatrick, 32, a mother of five, was found murdered. Her body had been stuffed in a trash bin in the same alley behind Ellis's mother's house, where Irene Smith's body had been found, also in a trash bin.
A little girl named Ebony Owens, who was 9 years old at the time, found Karen Kilpatrick's body. A neighbor paid her and her cousin 50 cents each to haul some trash to the neighbor's backyard bin. When Ebony opened the bin, a woman's legs popped up. When she was interviewed 15 years later, so she's 24, Ebony was still haunted by the memory, but remembered that the woman's nails were painted red.
Yeah, it's funny how your memory is like, I'm sure in her mind, she sees those nails and it,
is haunted by it, as she said. Poor thing.
Awful. Ellis was a former neighbor of Ebony's and a man she had known virtually her entire life. Later, when he was arrested, she said in disbelief, quote, I knew his whole family. They lived around here for years, unquote, commenting that he had come across as a regular old Joe.
Karen's live-in boyfriend, Curtis McCoy, was charged with the murder. Preparing for court, his attorney's investigators found 8 unsolved homicides they believed were similar to Karen's.
But the judge would not allow the defense to argue that there could be a serial killer loose in the city, nor would he order the police to turn over records in the other cases to the defense. One of the investigators was so distraught by the decision that he actually wrote a letter to the judge.
Good, good.
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder what is going through these judges' heads.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
something that clearly
needs to be looked at.
Needs to be looked at. And they just will say, no, thanks.
Yeah.
And because they're the judge, that essentially the final say, unless you have the resources to appeal, you're, that's kind of it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So luckily, Curtis McCoy was eventually acquitted. However, at the time, there was a public outcry and people complained McCoy had gotten off on a technicality and he lost everything. His children were removed from his care. His house was vandalized. His vehicle was towed and never returned. And by 1997, he just moved to Mississippi.
That's sad.
Yeah.
Not only that, but his girlfriend was murdered.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Beth. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, this ruined his life.
His
and
life.
He was not responsible for it, but yet made to be re-victimized in numerous ways because of the miscarriages of justice.
A month after Karen was murdered, Ellis was charged with attacking his girlfriend, Ethel Hardman, with a screwdriver. The charges were later dropped without explanation.
Yeah, this is, you know, another opportunity.
Domestic violence.
Yeah, intimate partner violence. A red flag.
Yeah.
By, you know, true crime watchers. But in the 90s, I don't think it was that big of a deal, to be honest with you. I mean, I think in some states, it was like legal to sexually assault your wife. know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's really unfortunate. But in 1995, 2 women and a teenage girl were murdered. Their bodies left blocks from Ellis's home. All 3 were eventually connected to Ellis's DNA.
The first was Florence McCormick, 28, on April 24th, 1995. She was found dead in the basement of a vacant home by workers doing repairs. The home was boarded up but had a broken window. Florence had been strangled to death and a clothesline was still wrapped around her neck when she was found. And Florence was the mother of 5.
On June 27th, 1995, the body of Sheila Farrior, 37 years old, was found. She had been strangled to death. The owner of the vacant residence went to inspect remodeling work when he discovered her body in a bedroom.
On August 30th, the body of Jessica Payne, a 16-year-old runaway from South Milwaukee, was found under a mattress in an area behind 2 houses, one vacant and the other a known location to obtain drugs. She was Ellis's only white victim.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's also interesting that he took the time to cover her because some of the other victims were just left in trash.
Right.
But exposed naked.
In houses
Yeah.
I wonder if her age had anything to do with it.
Yeah, I wonder the same. I also wonder if her race had something to do with it.
Maybe.
Like, you know, I wonder if he felt like he was doing something really wrong because it was a white woman and didn't feel, he's a piece of basura anyway.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say with this one, but questions that will remain unanswered forever. So anyway, her throat was slashed, her shirt had been partially raised, and her pants were pulled down to her ankles. An autopsy indicated that Jessica had been sexually assaulted before she bled to death. A rape kit was collected and semen was determined to be present.
1 month after the discovery of Jessica's body, an inmate at the Milwaukee County Jail told authorities that a man named Richard Gwynn was involved in a young white woman's murder.
Gwynn made a statement implicating himself and 2 others. 20-year-old Sammy Hadaway and 21-year-old Shantae Ott in Jessica's murder. Shantae Ott was eventually convicted of Jessica's murder.
Also in 1995, Ellis was charged with choking his girlfriend Ethel until she passed out. Again, the case was dropped without explanation.
Yeah, and I don't know if we'll ever know, but I mean, if the, again, it's the night. It was the 90s.
Yeah.
I don't think we took intimate partner violence as seriously as we do today. And also, yeah. If the victim and the officials don't want to pursue it, then it doesn't get
they
pursued.
Don't. Yeah.
Right. So on June 20th, 1997, another woman, Joyce Mims, 41, was strangled to death and her body dumped in a vacant house blocks from where Ellis lived. Building renovators went to the house to perform renovations and found her dead on the second floor. She was last seen by family members 2 days earlier walking from her home.
On February 17th, 1998, the body of Mariette Griffin, 39, was found partially clothed amidst a pile of garbage in a garage on North 7th Street in Milwaukee. She had been strangled.
I can't say enough how the pattern of dumping Black women in garbage is really disturbing to me.
It's and now very disturbing.
Now we're how many years in? Maybe 5 years into his murder spree?
No, more than that.
Yeah, and it's it just makes my blood boil.
Yeah.
So in March of 1998, a man named William Avery, 25, was questioned about Mariette's murder after she was linked to Avery's crack house on North Palmer Street. When Avery was questioned by police, he acknowledged being with Griffin early on February 17th.
But with little evidence linking him to the murder, police did not charge him with it. However, they did charge him with drug dealing. And William Avery was convicted in 1998 on narcotics charges and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
It's interesting. So there's pre-crime bill, right? He was getting in and out, parole, la, la, right. la. Post-crime bill gets 10 years for drugs.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting. Like, I get society's want to make everybody safe and put people away who are hindering that.
Yeah.
But the crack epidemic was really mishandled, if you ask me. Vote for me, Wendy Williams, for president. I just think, you know, gosh, it's all so frustrating looking back. But I get at the time, you know, maybe these were the best solutions. So charge him 10 years in prison for crack cocaine dealing. But by the way, the same, you know, I don't know how much crack he had on him, but people who had tiny amounts of crack would get 10 years in prison. But people who had the same or more amount of cocaine, which was back then in the 90s and 80s, considered a white drug, a white affluent drug, would get much less time. So
yeah.
Anyway, America. Then in 2004, after three prison inmates alleged that William Avery had confessed to killing Mariette, Milwaukee County authorities charged him with reckless homicide. One of the inmates recanted prior to trial and did not testify. The other two testified that Avery admitted to the murder. Avery was convicted on March 9th, 2005, and sentenced to 40 years in prison.
The system caught up with Ellis again in 1998, this time for beating a different girlfriend, Karen Thomas, with a hammer.
Hmm.
And doctors needed 52 stitches and staples to close her head wound.
My God. Ellis pleaded guilty to the attack on Karen and received 5 years in prison, but he would serve less than three. 1 year of that was spent in a Texas prison where Wisconsin was renting space in the late 1990s. Oh, interesting.
That's crazy.
I don't know. I might have my Midwest states that start with W mixed up, but one of these states, it's either Wisconsin or I don't know, the one where Paul Ryan was in leadership for a while. Their state makes a lot of money on prison inmates' bodies. They produce a lot of goods, and they also get to count their constituencies. Prisoners in Wisconsin are counted as constituents, even though they cannot vote. And so that gives these Midwest states that don't have enormous populations like on the coast a lot more power than I think is fair, if I'm being honest.
Warranted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Also at that Texas prison was a man named Napoleon Clark, who was in prison for first-degree sexual assault of a child. The two men would meet again in May of 2000 when they were moved to the Oshkosh Correctional Center.
Oshkosh? Oshkosh Bagosh?
Oshkosh Bagosh.
Oh my gosh. Was it called Oshkosh Bagosh?
Yeah, clothes.
Yeah.
There were Oshkosh Bagosh clothes.
It was, the Bagosh was included. We didn't just make that up in like rhymes. It was Oshkosh Bagosh. Okay.
Bagosh.
Fire. Yeah. That was hip hop air horse for Oshkosh Bagosh. Sorry. I love that shit. So where are we? As a sex offender, Clark had been forced to provide the state with a DNA sample under the law. Then, on January 1st, 2000, all felons were required to provide DNA samples. That included all state prisoners, which would have included Mr. Ellis.
And on February 4th, 2001, Ellis and 57 other inmates were ordered to give their DNA. By this time, there were at least 8 homicide victims with Ellis's DNA on them, providing an incentive for Ellis not to take that test.
It was easy for him to dodge it, which is so disappointing.
Yeah.
DNA is my hero. And this time, DNA didn't come through at this moment.
Well, it did eventually.
It did, but not at this moment. But prisoners took their files and they stood in line to have the insides of their cheeks swabbed. No photos were attached to these files or the DNA results. And Clark got in line with Ellis's paperwork and gave his DNA under Ellis's name. What?
Which is just crazy.
What?
Yeah. The sample went to the crime lab where an analyst spotted it as a duplicate of someone else they already had in the system and noted to a supervisor it was submitted under another person's name. But no one contacted the prison.
Really?
Yeah.
So Ellis left the prison in July of 2001. His DNA was still not in the system. He was not the only one who gamed the system, though. Officials later revealed that at least 12,000, again, 12,000 DNA samples for felons convicted since 2000 were not in the state database. Wow, that's a lot. That's too many.
That's too many. Yeah.
I'm sure there are arguments against being able to collect your DNA once you've been convicted of a crime, but I'm for it. I'm just going to say that. I know people think I'm like, what do you think that people should just not go to jail or not get in trouble or never be any police? But I do think that this, you know, keeping track of people's DNA who've done wrong, because I think you certainly have.
Well, it can also exonerate you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm all for it. Sorry.
Officials said they didn't think there was widespread fraud as occurred in Ellis's case, but no one has explained why the samples are missing.
I'm sorry. 12,000 doesn't seem widespread to anybody else here. I know it's Wisconsin and there's not a lot of people there, but 12,000 is
a lot
more than just. Yeah, it is definitely widespread. Wide and deep.
Yeah, no one has explained why the samples are missing beyond saying they were busy at the time. Too busy. Too busy.
Beth, can I ask you a question? If at your job something disastrous like this happened, could you just be like, I was just too busy at the time?
No.
And be totally like unscathed? No, I didn't think so. Me either.
After Ellis slipped through the federal and state systems, he would kill at least one more woman in 2007.
Quithron Stokes, who was 28 years old, was found murdered on April 27, 2007. She had been strangled to death. City inspectors found her body in a vacant, boarded-up residence, which had previously been used as a rooming house. So now we're going to move on to the investigation and the arrest. What the what, Beth?
As police searched for a suspect in the killings of several Milwaukee women from 1986 to 2007, local media dubbed the killer the Milwaukee Northside Strangler or the Northside Strangler.
The media loves a good moniker, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, well, it sells headlines and all that stuff.
Yeah, it does.
Gets eyes on their programs.
I get it.
Yeah. It's America.
Yeah.
But imagine if you didn't get money for salacious headlines or catchy things, you know? Like if...
Yeah.
Imagine. But in 2000, the Wisconsin Innocence Project began reinvestigating Shante Ott's case and filed a motion seeking DNA testing on semen from the rape kit collected during Jessica Payne's autopsy. The motion was granted. Oh, finally, a judge doing the right thing. And the Wisconsin State Police Crime Lab developed a male profile that excluded Ott.
However, police still maintained that Shante Ott killed Jessica.
Come on, you guys.
So get this, and we've heard this before. They claimed that Ott killed her after someone else had sex with her.
A serial killer
had sex with her, and then this guy killed her. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Makes no sense. I'm going to get into it in my takeaways, but basically, I was listening to the Daily Zeitgeist, and they were talking about like true crime in a nutshell is essentially harm against vulnerable people plus police incompetence. And then you end up with this recipe of true crime. And that's
disaster.
What's happened here.
Yeah. But on December 23rd, 2008, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals overturned Ott's conviction and ordered a new trial.
2 weeks later, on January 8th, 2009, Ott was released on bond. And on June 5th, 2009, the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office dismissed the charges. Good.
Finally.
Yeah. Gosh. This poor man.
Yeah. Also in 2009, Milwaukee detectives began reviewing the murders of 20 women in Milwaukee over a period of over two decades. Mm. Ellis's name kept popping up in crime reports. So
interesting.
Yeah. Police went to his home and got a DNA sample from his toothbrush.
Eventually, DNA evidence. Oh, thank God. DNA, you're back.
Finally.
You redeemed yourself. Eventually, DNA evidence linked Ellis to 9 murders. But the Milwaukee County District Attorney didn't feel that they had enough evidence to win convictions for the killings of Karen Kilpatrick in 1994 and Jessica Payne in 1995. So Ellis was charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of 7 women from 1986 to 2007. That's a lifetime. That's a whole lifetime of murders.
Yes, it is. And in April of 2010, William Avery, who had been convicted of killing Mariette Griffin, wrote to the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office requesting that DNA tests be performed on a sample taken from her body. The DNA tests excluded Avery and matched the profile of Walter Ellis. Mm. So that made 10 victims total suspected to have been murdered by Walter Ellis.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
All right, so now we are going to move into the trial.
Okay.
Initially represented by attorney Russell Jones, Ellis pleaded not guilty. Then on February 18th, 2011, Jones was withdrawn from the case. Ellis then pleaded no contest to 7 murder charges and was convicted, despite not actually admitting his guilt.
So my understanding is that he wanted to get rid of this attorney for some reason.
Yeah.
And then he wanted to represent himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then another attorney was assigned to him.
Yeah. And what do they say? A client who wants to represent help, or an attorney who wants to represent himself as a fool for a client. I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
The point
like
is
that.
It's
yeah.
stupid.
Not a good idea.
Also, I wonder, because Ellis strikes me as kind of like a narcissist and like a power hungry kind of guy.
Or wants to be in control.
Wants to be in control. Yeah. Yes. And so I think, you know, not every attorney gets along with his client. And maybe that's what happened here.
Yeah. On February 24th, 2011, Ellis was given 7 life sentences to be served consecutively without the possibility of parole.
Mm.
More than 30 friends and relatives of his many victims filled the gallery to witness his sentencing. 9 made formal statements.
Mm. That could not have been easy for them to have to do.
No.
But shout out to them for doing it.
For doing it.
Yeah. So Ellis declined his right to speak, and his attorney, Patrick T. Earl, also said he would offer no statements on his client's behalf. So to that end, Milwaukee serial killer Walter E. Ellis stayed silent about the 7 homicides he committed over 21 years.
After he was convicted, he was initially held at the Dodge Correctional Institution in Waupun, Wisconsin. He was then transferred to the Wisconsin Secure Program facility in Boscobel, Wisconsin. In November 2011, Ellis was transferred again to the Maximum Custody Unit at the South Dakota State Penitentiary.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's been to so many cool places.
He's traveled the whole Midwest. I mean, he's been to Texas, too.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. I was going to make a joke, but I won't. Now we're going to get into where are they now? So I'll tell you, Ellis died. He did. D-E-A-D dead. He died at Sioux Falls, South Dakota Hospital on December 1st, 2013, of apparent natural causes. Being evil isn't a cause of death, apparently. So according to the South Dakota Department of Corrections, that's what they said. So he was 53 and he served less than 3 years for the serial murders when he died.
Right. Yeah.
Seems unfair.
It's very unfair.
Mm-hmm.
The family of Irene Smith, the woman killed in 1992 while Ellis was bribing his way out of the halfway house, wonders what might have happened if the system had done its job with Ellis.
Girl, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a failure of many systems.
Yeah.
Now, Irene's daughter, Dominica Walton, said, quote, "It brings a lot of trouble to my heart because if they would have kept this guy incarcerated, like he was supposed to be, then at least my mom would still be here. It's hard to trust a system to protect the families and keep the violent people off the street because there is always a glitch in the system or somebody is always doing something unjust," unquote. Exactly. Yeah. No lies detected.
Yeah. Shante Ott received $25,000 in compensation from the state of Wisconsin, the maximum the state allowed. He also filed a federal wrongful conviction lawsuit that was settled in March 2015 when the city of Milwaukee agreed to pay $6.5 million.
Good.
Yeah.
They should have paid a lot more. And William Avery was released from prison in May of 2010. And on September 23rd, 2010, his conviction and sentence were vacated and the charges were dismissed. In April 2011, Avery filed a wrongful conviction lawsuit in the U.S. District Court in Milwaukee. During the civil lawsuit, both of the inmates who testified at his trial recanted their trial testimony.
The Wisconsin Claims Board awarded Avery $25,000 in compensation in December of 2012. In June 2015, a jury hearing the federal suit awarded Avery $1 million in damages.
Mm-hmm.
The trial judge set aside the verdict, but in 2017, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit reinstated the verdict.
So the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the case, and in October 2017, the city of Milwaukee agreed to pay the $1 million judgment plus $987,000 in fees and costs. But William Avery died in 2018. So,
yeah, didn't have that money for very long,
no.
If he even got it at all.
Yeah. And I would think that, well, they say when the person making the claim dies, then the claim goes away. The claim dies, too. But I wonder if maybe his family got it.
I hope they got it, too. Somebody got it.
Yeah,
I hope so.
So now we're going to get into our takes and what we think made Ellis snap. What are your thoughts, Beth?
Well, something I've noticed recently when we've talked about these killers' early lives is that a lot of serial killers come from big families.
Yes.
And Ellis was one of 6 children.
Yeah, that's too many kids.
Yeah. Well, not as big as some of the other families of serial killers,
yeah.
Like 10 kids.
Yeah.
But still, like you said, 6 kids is a lot of kids.
That's a lot.
Ugh. Yeah. It's really hard to make sure that all of your kids' needs are met.
Yeah,
when you have so many of them. And I'm not talking about like food and just clothing, emotionally, which is hard, sure. But just, emotionally.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
Yeah, it is. And I was listening to a podcast recently where they were talking about the Fundies, like the Duggars.
Oh.
And how they have so many kids, which means that the kids are almost guaranteed to be at the very least emotionally neglected because they're just, there isn't enough to go around.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And they have the older kids taking care of the
buddy
kids.
System. I remember the Duggar saying.
And so the older kids are parentified and they have to take care of these younger kids. So the younger kids are not getting the attention from the parents and the older kids aren't either. And so, it's all kind of fucked up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, I'm taking that nugget and receiving it and like implanting it in my spirit because it's an important, it's an important thing to consider, I think, when we're, thank you, Beth. Oh my God. What else? More fire hot takes, please.
So also he dropped out of school in the eighth grade. He was like 14.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably didn't have the skills. Never acquired the skills to get a decent paying job.
Right.
And people who fall through the cracks like that often turn to criminal activities to survive.
Survival crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stealing, dealing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like he was also doing drugs.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that he was probably angry at his lot in life. Mm-hmm. Probably, stuff happened in his childhood. Don't know.
Yeah.
But he was probably also hardened by prison.
Yeah. I mean, some of the clever schemes, like the DNA scheme, I never would have thought of something like that. Like and they say that sometimes when people go to prison, they learn to be better criminals rather than be rehabilitated. And
it's true.
Definitely think that that was the case for
Ellis. What happened. Yeah.
Also, as I was digesting this case, I never thought I'd say this in my life, but I was disappointed the DNA didn't come through earlier.
Right away.
Like, it could have saved so many people. And
they just had a dumb system for collecting the
error,
DNA.
The system was fucked. And lastly, I feel terribly for the victims, but this man who murdered women was allowed to keep doing so for a long time. And part of me can't help but think more would have been done to end this decades-long time of terror if those who, we task with solving crimes and doing the job of like public safety had done what they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
Because a lot was lost. I also can't say enough to mention earlier in my Culture Corner about the generation of Black men who were Ellis's father's age. And I've heard recently on a number of podcasts, I don't know what's going on, but a lot of men who are in Ellis's age range describing their fathers who were out in the world during the Jim Crow era. And their fathers were essentially emotionally unavailable. Or really hard on them when they came home, and everybody at home got it. And so that, it made me think of that and the ramifications that being treated as a second-class citizen and always trying to survive and just the ramifications of that for generations.
Yeah.
And also, he finally gets convicted and only served a few years in prison. And it's unfair.
Yeah.
No fair.
Yeah.
I can't think of a better word.
But at least he's dead.
Yeah. Yes.
That's the only good thing.
Yeah, he's not around to hurt anybody else or scheme anybody. I mean, he was really a destructive... He destroyed a lot.
Yeah, he did.
And he had no remorse. He didn't talk about the cases.
Never explained himself or anything.
But by his actions, I mean, it seems to me like he really did not care about human beings.
Life.
Yeah, or life. And he also didn't seem to give a shit about the people or the families or the three men who were wrongfully convicted for his crimes.
Yeah.
What is it? Shante Ott, Mr. Hardaway, Mr. Avery. Then I also thought about intimate partner violence and how, if the officials had intervened in those cases, we might be talking about a completely different scenario at this point.
Right.
Also, he was really callous with regard to how he treated women. Part of me wondered if maybe he saw women being treated that way in his youth.
Very possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he left them in like humiliating positions and just like dumped again amongst trash.
In the garbage. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there were so many system failures. Someone should be held responsible for those failures. Like the crime lab, the group home, and the wrongful convictions. And it's clear that Ellis was a very dangerous person. And these systems were supposed to prevent somebody that dangerous from being allowed to harm other human beings, you know?
Right.
And it's discouraging, but if those, I like to think that if those systems were created by people, they can be undone by us.
Yeah.
And they can be improved. But again, it's, you know, the true crime 101, vulnerable people being harmed plus police / official incompetence. And then you got a winning recipe of
equals true crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let us know what you think. You know how to get at us. Now we're going to move on to how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
Right.
What you got?
It's kind of a hodgepodge it's an Oshkosh bagosh, if you will, of tips. Watch self-defense videos. There are so many of them on the TikToks, on the Instagrams and the Facebooks and the YouTubes. Also, I found an account. It's called girlswhofight.co.
Ooh.
They have an Instagram account. They also have a newsletter with tips and discussions and encouragement so that you can become your own best protector.
Nice.
And they had a post recently about 6 ways to become more dangerous this year.
Ooh.
Again, from Girls Who Fight. 1, stop being nice. Stop making that a priority. It's not going to help you.
Yeah.
2, walk like you are the most badass motherfucking person on the planet. I add the motherfucking, but you get the idea. 3, make no a complete sentence. That's it. I don't need to explain.
All right.
That's
just
it.
No.
The answer is no. 4, observe more than you reveal. Make listening a superpower, because when people show you who they are with their facial expressions, body language, whatever they say, believe them.
Yeah.
5, the majority of violence women and vulnerable people, I'm counting LGBTQ, especially trans people, face, the majority of violence faced comes from someone close to them. So be intentional about who you let into your world, social media and the physical world. Use the block button. Block everybody and keep your peace. And 6, maybe that was 6. Anyway, it's okay to block
people. Maybe 6 was, it's okay to block people.
It's okay to block people on social media and in real life.
Yeah.
So that's all I've got.
Right. And we invite you to share your how not to get murdered or self-defense tips with us and get at us on our socials.
Yeah. So now it's shout out time.
Right on.
Where we get the opportunity to shout out, lift up any content by or about people of color, any marginalized folks, or any true crime goodies. And I see you typing, and I've seen this title and I didn't know anything about it. So I can't wait to hear you say it. But mine is a true crime goodie. It's called Quiet on the Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV. Now, I am a geriatric millennial. Nickelodeon was my TV diet for long. And it is tough to watch because I had no idea. And I would have given anything to be on Nickelodeon because it looks so fucking fun.
Yeah, they did make it look
fun.
They
sure did the slime. But in hindsight, boy, oh boy, is there a lot of sexual innuendo and predatory, nasty, nasty shit. It's disgusting. Mm. It's heartbreaking. It's maddening. And I felt like a gazillion emotions for these kids. And also, one of the child predators was pen pals with John Wayne Gacy. So,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
I know.
My God.
What do you got?
So I wanted to shout out a series on Max called Justice USA.
Okay. Yes.
And it's described as a 360-degree view of the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
It's 6-part docuseries, and it focuses on criminal justice reform, giving viewers an inside look at the life of the defendant. So it follows some of the defendants as they go through the system.
Oh,
and
it's on Max, you say?
It's on Max, and I haven't finished it, but so far it's good.
Oh, my God. Thank you, Fred. Okay, so to recap.
You're welcome.
True crime goodie. It's Quiet on the Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV. That's also, I watched it on Max, but it's on ID if you can't get it on Max. And then Justice USA, which is also on Max. And that is definitely a, I'm going to be watching it. Actually, I'm,
yeah.
See you later. Just kidding.
That's the end of the show. Bye.
The end of the show. Bye. But in the meantime, Beth, where can the people find us?
Well, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media.
Mm-hmm.
The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show. Also, join us on Patreon, where we have literally hundreds of hours of bonus content.
It's so crazy to think about it. There's like 400 hours.
Hours.
What the hell?
You can also support us by supporting our sponsors or by giving us a 5-star review.
5 stars only, please.
5 stars only, please. And don't forget to subscribe.
That's right. Also, if you're subscribed, listening to this on Google Podcasts, please. We love that you are here, but find us on another fantastic app.
Yeah, Google Podcasts is
going away. So, y'all, this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there. Quick sip of the tea. Oh my God, I'm so excited about this. Perfect temperature, perfect flavor. Let's go. Okay. All right. Oh, okay. Well, before I got thrown off quite a bit. Okay.
Ellis's pass records showed that he left the houseway house.
In an alley off of North 7th Avenue. The same
Street.
Alley. Oh, North Avenue. I'm going back to my South Phoenix days. Sorry.
We really do.
Fight me. Yes, we do. I will square up. So I'm going to square up with somebody because, yes, the Fruities are the best. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just going to keep reading. What were you going to say?
Keep reading.
The horm.
Sorry, I had a burp.
Kinnick.
Ott was arrested. I'm sorry. No, opposite. Another sip. This tea is so good. Yeah. It's got honey in. Oh my God. Have you tried monk? Is it monk fruit?
Yes.
Yeah. That's my new sugar substitute.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Got to be careful with it though, because it's got sugar alcohols.
What? What does that mean?
Sugar alcohols. It's just a type of sugar substitute. Like the monk fruit is like it's partially monk fruit and partially sugar alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue with sugar alcohols, and you can tell what they are. They all have etol at the end. Like sorbitol is the only one I can think of right now.
Okay.
Anyway, they can give you gas. That's all.
Oh, I love that. I was actually telling my daughter because you can keep this in mini or leave it out. I don't care. But I love sugar-free Werther's candies. And part of the reason I love
sugar
them
alcohols.
Yes, yeah. is because I get something sweet and it helps me poop. And pooping is like the only time in my life as it exists right now that I get to be like people don't bother me while I'm pooping. So I love it. Love every opportunity to poop. And so Werther's is my vehicle. And now that I know this about monk fruit, Bring it on. Yeah. Truckloads, please.
And most sugar-free candies have sugar alcohols in them.
Oh, I know. But I didn't know this about the monk fruit. And girl, call Costco.
You're on it.
Call Costco because we need some more. Beth is my wise friend who doesn't stress about small things.
Not really. Yeah.
Makes me feel very good about my existence.
3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 a.m., the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one, the one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.